Welcome to News and Brews. I'm Mike Heslin.
And I'm Eero Yabuke.
This week, we'll check in on Omicron and how one country's response could tank or save the global economy.
Speaking of China, we'll also discuss whether or not a Winter Olympic boycott actually matters.
Trump's newest failed social media play has a new COO. That's Chief Obsequiousness Officer. And guess who's back? The debt ceiling.
I don't have anything pithy to say about the debt ceiling, but speaking of Trump, Russia is amassing troops on the Ukrainian border, all part of Vlad's effort to make Russia great again.
All right. Well, with that, let's get into it.
Let's do it.
Hey, Earl.
Hey, Mike. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Happy Tuesday.
Yes, once again.
Can we call it Two Beer Tuesday? I know people are listening on Wednesday, but I have trouble disassociating from like the current period. So people are just going to have to run with it.
Yeah, I think people can appreciate in the morning time the beers that we're having in the evening time.
I mean, that's sort I'm of, not that's sure sort of I'll the, appreciate it, but
that's the bet we're making here.
How was your weekend?
Weekend was good. They're becoming, though, like a bit of a sprint between you know, various holidays and just like activities picking up again for the kids. It's like, you know, one has soccer while one has a birthday party. Then we're going to XYZ relative's house. And then like all of a sudden it's Monday again.
Yeah. And you're like, I need a weekend after my weekend.
Right. Right.
So I have a prop today.
Go on.
So people, of course, can't see this, but I'm going to describe what is in my hand right now. And it is a card that says "Happiest Holidays, the Heslin Family." And it has impossibly cute children on it. And then some rando in like a Crocodile Dundee hat holding one of those cute kids. And so I have a couple takeaways in addition to, you know, calling you out about your hat. The first of all is, it's December 7th and I have your Happy Holidays card in hand, which is
what you don't know is we were like in full pandemic fog last year and didn't send one. So this is last year's holiday card.
That can't be true.
No, it's not, but it's the first one we've sent in 2 years.
Are you trying to make me feel better? Is that what's happening? Cause like, cause related to that December 7th point is like, we're going to do a New Year's card this year. Just definitely not because we don't have our shit together. My wife doesn't listen to the podcast. And so it's, I can say that she takes issue with that. She's like, no, we were planning on doing this as a New Year's card. And I was like, no, we're not. We just didn't get our shit together.
You know what? The New Year's card is an elegant way around the concern that we run into as a mixed Jewish and Christian family around like what colors we use, what phrasing we use, what pictures we use. It sort of all has to, you know, not like we don't have to worry too much about anything. We just want to acknowledge sort of all of our own celebrations and influences. And it gets complicated, but the New Year's card is a way to get around that.
Yeah, let's go with that. We did it because we were
in honor of our celebration.
Honor of your and everybody else's celebrations. My other takeaway is that the middle photo on the cover has a decorated Christmas tree on it. And so if one thinks about this and works backward from December 7th, assuming that it took some time to order this, you not only got your shit together enough to send out a card, but you sent a card with your decorated Christmas tree and the kids actually smiling in front of said Christmas tree. So look, hats off to you.
So I can give you the story
with incredulity, but
I can give you the story on the Christmas tree, which is I talked last week about how for Thanksgiving we went up to Connecticut and saw some family we hadn't seen in a while.
Right.
The hotel we stayed in was decked out for Christmas, including that tree, among others.
Oh, that's not your tree.
No. And so like you know, after like the continental breakfast one morning, we were like, you know what? It's time. Let's get some photos. Slap them on the card.
Yeah. I mean, it's impressive. Well, kudos to you and to Bree and to Jacob and Natalie for obviously playing along and being their cute selves.
For listeners who may not be parents yet and may be thinking about it, the live photo feature on modern smartphones is just the absolute saving grace of all parents.
Oh, like, yeah.
Any cute pictures you see of kids that involve more than one smiling at one time is exclusively due to that feature.
Exclusively. Yeah. Portrait mode is like great and all, but it doesn't work with kids.
Portrait mode can't happen.
Pro tip, when you're doing the live, you have to back up a little bit. You can't frame perfectly because when you switch up according to the live, it, for whatever reason, zooms in a little bit.
Hmm.
If you don't want to cut off heads or feet, you kind of have to like anticipate the need to use the live feature and zoom out a little bit.
The word of someone who knows.
You heard it here, folks.
This is nice that we're actually talking about something we have expertise in on this podcast.
Child rearing.
taking photos of kids.
That I do have lots of experience with, much to the chagrin of my four-year-old. What are you drinking tonight?
I am drinking a Rogue Dreamland American Lager. Rogue is a great brewery out of Oregon. And the Dreamland is a nice, crisp, light lager that has a finish, not in flavor, but in a very specific way, like a bright espresso, where it's just got like a little bit of like subtle citrus acidity to it. And you kind of purse your lips. And it's a really nice drinking experience.
Also, I keep waiting for us to maybe like one day accidentally have the same beer.
Hmm.
We need to have some sort of like celebration if that happens. Because listeners, we never coordinate our beers because that would be weird and way too much planning. So I have a Manor Hill Brewing, or Manor Hill if you were in Austin, Texas, but we're not. And this is from Ellicott City, Maryland. And it is the Grisette, which is a farmhouse ale. And this beer sort of reminds me of like back to basics in beer. Like it's not a overly hoppy IPA. It's not trying to do anything with like hints of raspberry. It's just like, you know, after you come home from a hard day on the farm, you drink this beer on the porch. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a rocking chair. And it's lovely.
That sounds perfect. There we are.
It's perfect for Two Bear Tuesday. Shall we get in the first round?
Let's do it. We'll start with some good news today. California congressman and the only member of Congress to date who has tried to sue Twitter over a parody account pretending to be his cow, Devin Nunes, announced he'll be leaving Congress at the end of this month. This is great news on its own. This is a guy who was chairing the House Intelligence Committee while playing apologist for Michael Flynn having illegal contacts with the Russians. He encouraged people to go out to restaurants in March of 2020. He told the country the pandemic would be over by Easter of that year. He tried to expose the whistleblower who led to Trump's impeachment. He worked with Rudy Giuliani to try to get the Ukrainians to manufacture dirt on Joe Biden during the 2020 campaign, and a bunch of other consistently terrible stuff that's just been awful for the country. As a brief aside, after another congressman, Ted Lieu, made public comments about Nunes's shady dealings with Giuliani and his goons, Nunes threatened to sue him, and Lieu's response was, quote, "I welcome any lawsuit from your client and look forward to taking discovery of Congressman Nunes, or you can take your letter and shove it," end quote.
Ted Lieu's Twitter is really great. I don't know if this is on the Twitter, but I'm a fan.
Even better than Nunes being out of Congress, he is leaving to become CEO of the Trump Media and Technology Group. When asked about this news, Rupert Murdoch said, "CEO of Trump Media? I thought that was my job."
See what you did there.
But Trump Media is the vehicle behind Truth Social, Trump's widely panned social network that will reportedly be more than just a shitty blog, which is what his last social network was. They have already missed their own announced launch date of November 2021 for Truth Social, but they have still raised over $1 billion for it. With that kind of money, you could hire all sorts of qualified executives to run this thing. And my first thought when I saw this news was like, oh, Devin Nunes must have some tech business background. You know, there are plenty of like terrible politicians who were at one time successful business people. Daryl Issa comes to mind. He is was in the last decade the chair of the House Oversight Committee. He's also a California Republican. And he, incidentally, is the reason we don't have fully legal weed in D.C.
Because so he was the one. That's your analysis of why he's terrible?
It's one of many reasons, but you know, it's one that it's one that I see locally. But he was like business guy before this. He like ran a car alarm company in the 80s when everyone wanted car alarms because crime was going crazy, and got super rich off of it, and you know, bought up some other companies, and you know, knows about running organizations and technology. But Nunes's background is in dairy farming. Now, yeah, that's not to take anything away from dairy farming. Like, I have two kids. We go through a ton of milk, and it's, I'm sure, very hard to do it well, right? No question. It's just a different hard thing than the hard thing of running a successful consumer technology company, which is also extremely hard. All to say, I would not have counted myself among the bulls on Trump's media company before this announcement. I would say probably even less so now. And, you know, Devin Nunes, don't let the door hit you on the way out.
This is a really fascinating story to me, because on a serious note, if you follow DC and you know Congress a little bit, if Republicans had taken the House of Representatives in 2022, as many predict they will, he was like on the very, very, very short list to be chair of the Ways and Means Committee in the House of Representatives, which is an incredibly powerful position from a very wonky policy, you know, wielding power in Washington perspective. It's like nobody understands what the hell Ways and Means does, except for people with power in Washington, D.C. And so it just, to me, this is like a signal. I mean, there's folks like Nunes and even some of the wackier ones like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Madison Cawthorn and all these kind of folks who just are looking for likes on Twitter that are judging themselves by not only their proximity to Trump, but like the number of appearances on One America News Network and Fox News. And they're not actually judging themselves on influence or policy relevance. Now, the policy relevance part, of course, like that's like a high-minded ideal that maybe never existed. But like you at least, if you were in Congress, you at least wanted to be in Congress, and you wanted to progress in Congress and be part of leadership. And there was at least some like deference to trying to make the country a better place and sort of be there for my constituents and be there for my country. And this is not like Nunes and all these other ones are very clearly not that. They're just like in it for the hits, in it for the likes.
And don't forget the personal enrichment.
So then there's the like more sort of, you know, why are they doing that? One is probably attention, but also two is probably personal enrichment. So I have a story about the Winter Olympics. So as approximately zero of our listeners probably know, the Winter Olympics are going to take place next year, which may be confusing because the Summer Olympics just took place this year, but you know, for reasons that we can understand. So the 2022 Winter Olympics are going to be in Beijing. And the US announced this week that there was going to be a diplomatic boycott of the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing. In practice, this really means that the First Lady won't be there to cheer on the athletes. I mean, I don't know if you remember, Mike, this summer when Dr. Joe Biden went and she met with all the swimmers, and she went to, I think, the opening or closing ceremonies and was just kind of there waving the flag and having a good time.
No, you know what I remember that I'm actually sad that we'll miss out on is the last Winter Olympics that were in South Korea, when Mike Pence went and went up to the border with North Korea and just stood on a tower and like pointed his dumb face at the North Koreans like it was supposed to mean something.
I don't remember that at all. I think I probably willfully put that out of my memory. So I have a slightly perhaps controversial opinion on this. And I think it's a controversial opinion because this had bipartisan, this decision to boycott from a diplomatic perspective. Now, we should be clear, American athletes are still planning to go as of now. But the diplomatic boycott, I think, was a missed opportunity. There was bipartisan support for this on the Hill. there were certainly human rights advocates and some sort of anti-China types who said that this was a good idea. But I think that's like a, I think that's a missed opportunity, because I think we had an opportunity here to highlight some of the human rights violations and other just terrible stuff that is happening in China and that China is doing elsewhere on the biggest stage imaginable. So a little bit of a thought experiment here. Imagine we're sometime in the future, let's say 2040, and looking back, what do you remember? Do you remember that time that the First Lady didn't go to the Winter Olympics a few years back because, oh wait, I can't really remember what the reason was, but, and wait, where was the Olympics that were being boycotted? Or do you remember that time in 2022 where Kamala Harris went to Beijing, cheered on the bobsledders, and then met with Chinese dissidents across the region before and after the games, said the word Xinjiang publicly 34 times over the course of 2 days while she was in China, publicly snubbed Chinese Communist Party officials, and ended her trip with a pro-democracy rally in Taiwan, or better yet, Hong Kong? Which one of those do you remember if you're in the future?
Yeah, that makes total sense to me. My concern with hearing this news was, one, I get why you don't do a full boycott. You know, there's a lot of athletes that have put their entire lives into preparing for this moment in America. You know, and we have a complicated relationship with China. This isn't the middle of the Cold War. There's a lot that we need to work with them on simultaneously. That being said, my concern with this is that the administration will see this move as somehow sufficient to make the statement we need to make in the face of an active genocide happening in Xinjiang. And it's just nowhere near that.
Yeah, I don't think anybody thinks it's sufficient, but I think there was this, I don't know what their calculus was. I obviously wasn't in the room, but I think there was just like a, since there was bipartisan support and since there was, you know, human rights advocates were calling for this, et cetera, there was like, okay, well, this is a fairly easy thing that we can do. Is like, during a pandemic, let's not send the First Lady. Like, okay, fine. But again, just to hammer my point, like, do you remember, trivia question, Mike, when was the last time the U.S. boycotted an Olympics?
So it was definitely Cold War. Was it 84?
Close. 1980. Why did we boycott?
I don't know.
Because the USSR invaded Afghanistan.
Oh, wow.
You know who remembers that?
You
Nobody.
Do.
No, I literally had to Wikipedia it. But like, imagine what Olympic moments we do remember from the last 100 years. We remember Jesse Owens standing on the like winner's podium in the gold medal spot.
Yeah.
In 1936 in Berlin, as everybody's putting up the like Heil Hitler symbol. We remember Tommy Smith and John Carlos raising that fist at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City. We may not remember the details of those, but we remember those images and the on the biggest stage imaginable. And in 36, it's like you can imagine, you know, Hitler saying all these terrible things about, you know, the superiority, athletic and otherwise, of the Aryan race. And then you've got Jesse Owens, who just totally owns everybody and disproves this theory outright. And, you know, maybe a small thing, but like, I don't know, if you're going to use the Olympics, if you're going to make a statement at the Olympics, this just seemed like the sort of most toothless of all toothless.
Well,
options.
I mean, let's hold out some hope that maybe my concern and yours will be allayed, which is, those examples you gave were athletes.
That's true.
Right. Nobody remembers the statements that politicians made when they were at the Olympics as spectators. And so maybe by having the U.S. delegation still go and still participate, we're opening up opportunities for some of that activism in the arena to happen.
It's a lot to ask of athletes, right? And I know that there's been like athlete activism that's been on the rise, but it's also been pretty selective. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, the WTA has just said that they're not going to do events in China because one of the, you know, Chinese tennis player accused a high ranking Chinese Communist Party official of sexual assault. That tweet got taken down and then she sort of disappeared and then had like a super weird conversation with the IOC president.
Well, so
like, I'm fine.
The IOC has not availed well of itself in this situation. It just is very transparently icky the way they're kind of cozying up to the CCP in advance of the Winter Olympics. And this stunt, I don't think convinced anyone of anything, and actually somewhat made the problem worse. A little bit of the Streisand effect happening there. And so, you know, I think the athletes have been in the lead on that issue. You know, the first tweet that I saw about Peng Shuai was from Serena Williams. There were a number of other tennis players tweeting out about
Djokovic,
that.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So I don't know. Let's see what happens.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say on this, and then I promise I will step off this soapbox, is that they have been cozying up to the CCP. And in fact, the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, has been really deft in their maneuvering and manipulation of the IOC. They knew in anticipation of the Beijing Olympics that there, you know, were going to be athletes that wanted to protest or whatever. So they actually changed within the last couple of years. They had the IOC change a rule. It's called like Title 50 or something, or Rule 50. And it's basically banning political protests by athletes during the games. And there's all sorts of things that they are not allowed to do. And the penalties are real. Like they could actually lose medals and other things. So it's like, when I say it's asking a lot from athletes, it's asking more than just like, you know, Giancarlo standing up with his fist, right? Like that, there would be severe repercussions for that. And I don't think that's fair for us to ask athletes, especially when the sort of, there's been this diplomatic boycott.
Oh, I'm not assuming that we have a contingent of bruiser Winter Olympians listening. I'm not actually asking them to do things. I'm hoping a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Many things, Errol, have been called a cancer on our country. Trump and his cult of personality, racism in all its metastatic forms, gun worship and fetishization.
What about cancer? But is cancer?
You know, okay. But we also have a pesky STD collectively that we almost forget about until it flares up once again. And that, of course, is the debt ceiling. We're expected to reach the public debt limit again next week on or around December 15th. If you're feeling like we just got over a flare-up, you're not wrong. It was just in October that Congress passed a bill to raise the debt ceiling when a small number of Senate Republicans agreed to extend the debt limit, but only until right now, this very moment.
Yeah, so they're talking about this like right now.
Well, and when it's been moving fast this week. So when I started drafting this outline, it was basically like the first stories were emerging, we're about to hit this wall and nobody has a plan. By the time we are recording this on Tuesday night, there actually is a plan, and it's like a pretty decent one.
Yeah. If they want to act, they can. I mean, this happened with like government funding as well. The alarm bells were raised and one morning it got done. They kicked the can down the road until February, but still got done.
Right. So as of Tuesday evening this week, congressional leaders in both parties announced that they've reached a deal on a bill that would allow an increase to happen before we hit that deadline next week. And so Mitch McConnell has essentially, and so the real blocker is the Senate, where you need 60 votes to pass anything that's outside of the reconciliation process, which is already tied up with the Build Back Better bill. Mitch McConnell, minority leader in the Senate, has given his blessing and support to a deal that would allow a complex legislative maneuver enabling 50 votes to pass this increase in the debt limit outside of the reconciliation process nested in another bill.
How magnanimous.
And so, I mean, on one level, I think those who believe McConnell is a 3D chess master are thinking that, you know, because this has to be a dollar amount debt limit increase rather than a time-based debt limit increase, that he's basically, you know, playing for the campaign ads where he can go and paint all the Democrats as big spenders who are reckless with the nation's credit. However, Republicans are going to do that anyway. It doesn't really matter what Democrats do. And I don't think the average voter is masochistic enough to pay too close attention to every single time this debt limit flares up. And so I think, you know, there are a lot of other outlets. I saw this, the New York Post, for example, framed this as McConnell blinks again, which I think is actually probably closer to reality. I mean, unhelpful in that there shouldn't be a standoff about this. It's really backwards and tiresome that the debt ceiling is even a thing, right? There's no reason that that should exist. We have the legislative process of appropriations to decide how much we want to spend and by how much we, our elected leaders are comfortable increasing the nation's debt, right? You don't need the ceiling in addition to it. It's not helpful. That being said, you know, the sort of more extremist elements of the Republican Party were taking a hard line here and wanted McConnell to hold out and basically play chicken with the full faith and credit of the United States. And I think there is some credit he deserves for not playing that game again, which has been really destructive over the last like 10 years.
Yeah. It's funny in the sad way that those same folks didn't seem to have a problem with the debt ceiling from the years 2017 through the end of 2020. But
of course,
but sure, let's give Mitch McConnell some credit.
A news and brews first. So let's pick up where we left off last week.
Omicron or Omicron.
The Omicron variant continues to spread around the world. No one continues to have any confidence in the way they pronounce it. Cases have now been identified in 38 countries, up from 19 a week ago. Scientifically, we know right about the same amount about the risks from Omicron that we did last week, which is nothing. Before we get into the rest of this, I'll mention one story just to reiterate the risk of well-meaning misinformation. So I was listening to a discussion among NPR reporters earlier today, where they threw out this stat that Omicron now accounts for 14% of positive cases in the US. And I was actually starting to write
really
that
high
into our outline. And I was like, wait a minute, that sounds really high. And looked
it
a little bit further, there have been like a few dozen cases identified in the US total. And 14% is the share of positive cases that are getting sequenced at all in the US. Like, genomic sequencing is happening on 14% of positive cases.
And we don't do genomic sequencing on every positive test, is what you're saying.
Right, on 14% of them.
We don't do this sequencing on, like, every positive test is in, I'm sure, in the tens of thousands per day, right? Like, we have high levels of COVID, right?
Right, but that's what the stat is. 14% of those positive tests actually get sequenced.
Oh, 14% get sequenced.
Yes.
And of those that are sequenced, some are Omicron.
Correct.
Oh, that's super misleading.
Yeah. Luckily, you know, so all to say, I'll reiterate the point from last week, continue consuming news about Omicron with caution. Luckily, on this show, we don't let a lack of knowledge stop us. So let's talk anecdotes and speculation, Errol.
Yeah. I was actually just laughing in my head and maybe even out loud when you were like, we know nothing more, but let's talk about it.
That's
I was
right.
Like, yes, let's talk about it.
So there are some additional indications that this virus spreads quite quickly. The UK saw cases climb 2.5x between last Friday and this Monday. They're still at 336 total. It's not a huge amount, but it is rising quickly. Denmark saw cases quadruple over those same 3 days to 261 cases. We should note that both of those countries, like South Africa, have excellent public health infrastructure and sequence
right.
the genome of a large proportion of their COVID cases. So that's one reason we're hearing about them before other countries. More encouraging, there are signs that this variant may cause less severe symptoms than its predecessors. So far, there have been zero deaths linked to Omicron around the world.
Wait, even in South Africa? I thought there were some deaths.
Zero total.
Oh, fascinating.
So what is happening in South Africa is that doctors there are reporting that among those hospitalized who have tested positive, most actually came in for other reasons and tested positive once they got there, since they're just testing any patient who comes in.
Oh.
And then their average length of stay once they get to the hospital has been only 2.8 days, much less than the 8.5 day average for COVID patients over the last 18 months.
You know, that's fascinating. And in more important news, I've been watching The Morning Show on Apple TV Plus, and this just happened to Jennifer Aniston.
She
went to the hospital because she had a fall, and it was March 2020, and she tested positive for COVID because she like surreptitiously went to Italy.
Totally. I'm through season two.
Oh, really? Show, so, okay. Yes. I haven't watched the season finale, so don't ruin it for me.
And no spoilers.
Two other listeners.
No spoilers, unless you're not up to that place where Jennifer Aniston gets COVID yet. So there are some slightly less encouraging signs on vaccine resistance. So, you know, I think the initial indications that we've seen are that prior infection does not protect as well against Omicron as it has against prior variants. We just, like, within the hour before we started recording here on Tuesday night, story broke that they published a very small study today suggesting that the Pfizer vaccine on its own is less effective against Omicron than it has been against prior variants. That's not to say it's not effective at all, and they don't know anything about the impact on hospitalizations or deaths. There were a total of 12 subjects of the experiment. So, you know, this is still very early and can't really draw any conclusions from that.
I almost feel like an N of 12 is undeserving of a news report and the moniker study.
So I looked at the study itself, actually, and not only was it an N of 12, but the period since vaccination among the vaccinated subjects that they
sampled, over 6 months or something.
Well, no, it was like less than 2 weeks. It was like an average of 12 days. And so
people just got vaccinated.
Right. Like that, you're not even supposed to be immune by then. So anyway, that was like one chart that I looked at very quickly, and I'm not a scientist. So again, just no conclusions yet on that, but that is one indication that, you know, it may end up being important that we have an Omicron specific booster coming out, you know, in the next couple of months. It may be even more important that we get the antivirals up and running, et cetera.
Yeah. So a group of anecdotes showed something.
Right. Right. The plural of anecdote is data.
Is not study.
So one theory on this is that viruses tend to become more transmissible but less virulent over time, as like a general trend.
Oh, interesting.
So
like in other viruses, non-COVID viruses?
Right. So like put yourself in the shoes of a virus, which I know you do regularly.
I do all the
time.
Didn't
see your Halloween costume, but I can only assume.
It was spiky.
Your evolutionary goal is to replicate as much as possible, which means infecting as many hosts as possible. So you want people to catch you easily and then to be well enough that they can interact with other people who can catch you while they're infected. So I was actually reading an article from Gavi, the global vaccine NGO. Mm-hmm. Which came out in July, so pre-Omicron and actually pre-Delta even, they noted that the flu viruses that caused the 1918 pandemic and the 2009 swine flu did evolve to get less virulent over time. And that actually the virus behind an 1890 pandemic that killed more than 1 million people is what they think evolved to become the common cold today.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I mean, this is, I remember when Ebola was a thing, and this is actually why the concern over Ebola was significant, but not actually amongst epidemiologists, not actually that scary, mm-hmm. because it was actually killing people too fast.
Mm-hmm.
Why COVID was scary is because it was in that sweet spot where it was like asymptomatic for a little while, and then you were transmitting during that time, but then like it wasn't killing everyone.
Yeah, the asymptomatic spread was like continues to be such a secret weapon for COVID.
Yeah. The other part of this morning show bit that really got me on the last episode, Mike, was like when they had the doctor on talking about hand washing, and I was like, oh.
Yeah.
Remember when COVID can be controlled with 20 seconds of really rigorous hand washing?
Yeah, that's right. Now that we know it's all respiratory, I don't wash my hands at all anymore.
Yeah, I just stopped washing my hands. Yeah.
So we talked last week about the immediate policy response to the identification of Omicron, marked by travel bans and a drop in oil prices and stock markets around the world. And we talked specifically about the travel ban the US put on 8 countries in Southern Africa, which, while not totally unjustified given how rapidly the new variant was spreading through South Africa and Botswana especially, also results in real hardship for those countries and may have felt like a punishment for South Africa's impressive and courageous work in reporting the outbreak early. One of our biggest concerns with the ban was that these blunt measures can be really hard to roll back. So Dr. Fauci was asked about that this week, and he said, quote, "That ban was done at a time when we were really in the dark. Hopefully we will be able to lift that ban within quite a reasonable period of time. We all fear very badly about the hardship that it places on the affected countries." So, end quote.
Maybe they'll listen to him.
there are at least some acknowledgement. And, you know, it's nice to have an administration in place where the cruelty is not the point. Fair. Last week, President Biden announced that at-home tests would become much more widely available and affordable, with health insurers required to cover the cost fully. Mm. Now, this week, there were signs that the administration may not be thinking as creatively about testing as they could. Jen Psaki, White House press secretary, was asked, why not just make them free? And said, oh, should we just send one to every American? In kind of a very like glib way.
Like a dismissive way.
Asking a question sarcastically, to which the answer is actually yes. Like in the UK, anyone yeah. over the age of 11 can request 2 packs of 7 tests to be mailed to them like every single day, or they can pick them up free from any pharmacy, library, community center, testing site. So it's not like that was some crazy out there suggestion.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bigger country, but we're also a bigger country. Yeah. I feel like that's not actually, there's a lot of bad questions that are asked to Jen Psaki, and maybe that wasn't one of them.
Right. Right. That being said, you know, testing is important. The fact that we're increasing access to at-home tests is a really big step. I think when Biden took office, there were 0 at-home tests approved by the FDA. There's like 7 out there now, and now they're all going to be effectively free for everyone.
How does this work, by the way? Have you done an at-home test?
I have. Yeah. I picked them up at like CVS. It cost me like $20 at the time, but.
And you like swab your nose and do what with it?
You swab your nose. You put the swab into a little clasp. There is a solution that mixes with the swab and saturates a testing strip within the clasp that you can see. And then it's just like a pregnancy test. There's like an indicator line and a control line. And if that indicator line turns blue, you've got not a baby, maybe a baby, but definitely COVID.
Is this classified as like a PCR or
no? It's an antigen test. The at-home tests are antigen because they're like immediate.
Okay, interesting. I'll have to look into this because we might or might not travel over the holidays, so need to look into this.
It's super easy though. It's like you don't have to like do the full brain swab or anything. It's just like 5 seconds in each nostril, and then you clasp it in and see what happens.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Continue.
So on testing, we talked about testing everyone who comes into this country as an idea, you know, to sort of control more effectively and less painfully than things like a travel ban. That is now happening at 4 major US airports, but they're also increasing requirements on the departure side. So this week, the US began requiring proof of a negative COVID test within 24 hours of flying into the country, which is down from the 72-hour limit previously.
So this is like any airport where there's a U.S. bound flight, you have to show a negative test.
Anyone coming into the U.S.
Yeah, which actually makes sense, right? Because if for anyone who has flown back into the U.S. or for international listeners, anybody who has flown into the U.S., you know that there's like inevitably a separate terminal with like a separate, you know, security line that you have to go to. So it's there's already kind of separate systems for going to the US. And so just adding on this sort of testing requirement to airlines who already have to go through a bunch of, you know, tailored US specific security stuff doesn't seem like actually that big of a lift.
There are some logistical concerns with a 24-hour limit, right? Most PCR tests take 24 hours to come back. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know exactly what the requirements are, but if you're looking at antigen tests, if you're asymptomatic, those may not show up positive. So there could be some concerns there. It could just be less convenient for people traveling, but that's something that we'll just have to deal with. Now, China, for its part, said that it would keep international flights at just 2.2% of pre-COVID levels in an effort to maintain its zero COVID policy.
Good luck with the Olympics.
Right. These severe restrictions, coupled with the frequent local lockdowns required to maintain zero COVID, are continuing to dampen the performance of China's economy. And they could also become harder to sustain and more painful to relax with a variant that spreads more quickly.
Interesting. Tell me more.
Well, yeah. So China's it's putting itself a bit in between a rock and a hard place with this zero COVID policy. I think if the Omicron strain does prove to be much less virulent and more like a flu or the common cold in practice, maybe they end up relaxing and dealing with that sort of explosion of cases. But it's hard to see an elegant way out of the zero COVID policy for them, particularly as the country that's hosting the Olympics, to your point. Now, it's also causing problems for them now because of the damper it puts on economic growth. So we've talked before about China's slowing growth rate. And this week, The Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, which is a government-run think tank, set a growth target of 5.3% for 2022, which is below the target of over 6% that they had set for 2021. So continuing to see a slowdown. At the same time, China's central bank cut the reserve ratio requirement for the country's banks, which essentially allows banks to lend and invest more money. So they're putting more money into circulation in the economy. It's effectively the same thing as cutting interest rates. It's monetary stimulus for the economy, because the banks now have to hold less money in reserve so they can lend and invest more. Now, that move was accompanied by a statement from China's Politburo, which is its top decision-making body, chaired by President Xi, saying that its top priority for 2022 would be maintaining quote-unquote stability, which observers interpret as a focus on preventing further slowing of growth. So they also acknowledged, you know, that the recovery may not be as smooth as they had hoped, that the economic situation may be a little bit more complicated than they had previously acknowledged, which in one sense is bad. But the fact that they are actually taking real steps to stimulate the economy, acknowledging that maintaining a strong economy is a top policy priority, was actually seen as a really positive thing by the markets and global observers. So on that news and on the indications that Omicron might not be as bad as some had feared, markets are actually like totally getting their groove back this week. So U.S. stocks on Tuesday had their biggest rally in 9 months and are now back to where they were before Omicron emerged on the scene, you know, November 24th. Crude oil prices are also recovering, up about 10% in the last week. So, you know, just to sort of put a bow on these interrelationship between the virus and the global economy and what's happening and how it's affecting everything. We're sort of seeing things start to tick back up this week after taking a bit of a dive in the face of Omicron.
Until they see the study with 12 people.
Yeah, we'll see how that goes.
Should we get into our main story?
Let's.
So this story is both related to news that is currently happening, but also this is a story that's far from over. And so this week, I want to take listeners to the Russia-Ukraine border. And I thought I would tell a little bit about what's going on and what has been in the lead up to this, such that when inevitably something happens over the next few months, we have a little bit better of an understanding of what's going on. And one of the reasons why I love this podcast is because it forces me to do something that I've been wanting to do for a while, which is like figure out what the hell is going on the Russia-Ukraine border. Because I've been reading about, you know, like any good American, I only read the headline and it's like, Russia is building up troops. Is Russia going to invade? And so I was trying to figure out in the lead up to this podcast, what's going on. The reason that I think it's important to talk about it now is not just because it's in the news, is because Russia is very obviously mobilizing its military forces near Ukraine. Of course, Russia denies this, but, you know, satellite imagery, it's like there's only so many places you can hide. And of course, U.S. intelligence officials using satellite imagery and, of course, other methods have said that Russia is planning to deploy an estimated 175,000 troops near the Ukrainian border, almost half of whom are already there. So there was a similar buildup in the spring, and there was kind of a, you know, the DC policy community, this was early in the Biden administration, it's like, oh, is the first crisis going to be Russia invades Ukraine? And it didn't turn out that way, in part because that was apparently a military exercise or something. And so as far as I can tell, the buildup that's happening now, though, is not a military exercise. And so these fears that people have.
And this one, I think, is a little more concerning because not only do they have more troops there now, as you said, like between 75 and 90,000 troops, but they also have established the supply lines for food and medical services and supplies and, you know, the infrastructure that they would really need to launch a ground invasion.
Yeah, there's like new buildings going up, right? There's like new barracks and warehouses. And I mean, there's very obviously not just a temporary buildup. And if you look at the images of the Ukrainian side of the border, a lot of it looks like World War One, like they're in trenches and, you know, obviously they don't have as many troops as the Russians do. And so there's lots of, I think, very credible fear in Ukraine that like the big bad wolf is under the covers pretending to be grandma. You know, it's probably what's happening now is probably tied at least in part to increased hostilities between Russian and Ukrainian backed militias, like in Crimea, for example, which I'll talk about in a second.
Well, but okay, let me just pause. Who's the aggressor in those hostilities?
I mean, but this is the thing, is like, we're probably not ever going to know what the actual information is. I mean, you talked about misinformation around Omicron. Like, what is actually going on there is more of an information war than it is an all-out war right now. But there have been increased hostilities. Okay, I'll just jump to Crimea. So like in 14, Russia invaded Crimea, but like soft invaded. It was just like they were supporting the militias and there were Russians that were there, but like they were volunteering or whatever. And so there's actually still Russian military people there. And according to the Ukraine military, those Russians are actually commanding those militias in Crimea. Of course, once Russia did that, then there was like this, you know, referendum, and Crimea was like, no, we actually want to be part of Russia. So Russia was like, welcome, friends. You are now, and they annexed Crimea. So they basically claimed part of Ukraine to be the eastern part of Ukraine to be part of Russia. And that, of course, made
right in addition Ukraine to Crimea. Angry. So Crimea is the peninsula in the kind of the southeast of Ukraine. They also invaded the eastern part of mainland Ukraine.
Yes, there's lots of invasion happening.
Right.
And so there's still this sort of dispute over who controls, you know, well, there's not a dispute over who controls. Russia controls it, but there's a dispute over what country it's part of. And so there are these active militias. Both sides signed a peace agreement in 2015 to like stop outright hostilities. But what's been happening recently and why we're talking about this now in part is because those militias have been fighting again. And so Russia is on the one hand saying, no, we're not getting ready to invade Ukraine. We're basically just like, we're worried about these like Western-backed Ukrainian militias, and we're worried that they're going to attack the eastern parts of Ukraine, which are now part of Russia, or even further into Russia. So they're like, they're just playing defense, right?
So which is such, which is such classic Putin, right?
Yes.
Like instigate, poke, provoke some sort of response, even if it's just a defensive response, and then claim victimhood and, you know, rally around the flag in service of that victimhood, and then try to extort whatever you can out of, you know, out of Joe Biden or the Western coalition or whoever you can.
Yeah. And look, in 2015, it was pretty successful. I mean, I'm not an expert of the peace agreement in 2015, but if you read about it, even for 5 minutes, you'll see Russia got kind of a lot out of that, including the ability to continue with their annexation of these eastern parts of Ukraine in a way that was successful. And so that, of course, happened during the Obama administration. And I'll get to the sort of current U.S. response in a little bit, but it's worth remembering that that happened in 2014 and 2015. So there's obviously like Putin shenanigans here, but there's like something a little bit deeper and longer term that's happening with Putin, I think, here. And so if you think about borders generally across the world, like they've largely been unchanged since World War II, with significant shifts coming in the latter half of the century when like former colonies became independent, right? But generally speaking, if you look at a map of the world in the 1950s, it's not radically different from where it is today. And certainly from the mid-1990s, it's very similar to what we see today.
Right. And so post-collapse of the Soviet Union.
Post-collapse of the Soviet Union. So this idea, whereas like, you know, our great-grandparents' generation, there was invasions of other countries, it seemed, all the time, right?
And by the way, there's this really cool TikTok account where this guy finds old globes and based on the specific borders on the globe narrows down when it was created and can usually get it down to like a, you know, 7-month period in 1972 or whatever. Yeah. It's awesome.
So I do this whenever I see a map. I'm like, is Sudan and South Sudan separated? And if the answer is yes, then it was after 2011. And if the answer is no, it was before. I also have a map in my office at work. Man, this is quite the tangent, but I love me some good maps. I have a map that was given to me by a Turkish family friend, and it is a map of Turkey, but the script is Arabic script that I have been told by someone is Ottoman Turkish. And yet there is on the map a modern Turkish flag, which is the red flag with the crescent moon and the star. And so if you know about Turkish history, Turkey became a republic in 1923 and they adopted that flag, but then they outlawed Arabic script in 1928. That map, which actually is a historical map of Ottoman something or other, was created during the years of 1923 and 1928.
That's awesome.
The reason I bring up maps is because all-out invasions is not all that normal. You know, you think about like tanks rolling across borders in World War II or whatever. And like, that's not really how it's played out, except in the last 15 years by Russia. You know, they invaded Georgia, they invaded Crimea. Again, they claimed that it wasn't their people, but it was like...
Which, as a callback, Georgia happened during the 2008 Olympics.
Oh, really?
Yep. Which were also in China.
Yeah, I do remember that they were in China, but I wonder if they was like strategically timed to just divert attention.
Maybe he's trying to run it back.
Maybe. Anyways, so I think that this is Russia is certainly an outlier. So the people that are concerned that Russia is going to invade are not crazy. Like this actually could very well happen. There's precedent for this. But of course they continue to deny it. And they're saying like whatever forces it does have near the border is because it fears a Western-backed Ukraine attacking its own territory. And it's just like the next logical step of that is they fear Ukraine joining NATO and thus NATO sort of being on its border. And they fear kind of big old Western guns being planted right on its, you know, Western Russian border. So that's one potential explanation of what's going on now.
Hopefully I'm not getting too far ahead of you, but in the call that Biden had with Putin today, there was some speculation that was basically Putin's ask, that he was going to ask for a firm commitment that NATO would not expand into Ukraine.
Yeah. And there was a 2-hour video call. Apparently, Putin was at his summer house in Sochi, and Biden was in the Situation Room. So, with like Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan and other high-ranking officials. So
was that the same Sochi house that Navalny's team exposed as having been bought with all this corrupt, ill-gotten money?
Yeah, in anticipation of the Sochi Winter Olympics,
yeah.
I'm pretty sure. I'm guessing. I don't keep an inventory of Putin's, you know, palaces, but like, yes is the answer. Like that NATO, that NATO point is, I think, the main point. But I think that there's something a little bit deeper than that. And I think that like dictators and aspiring dictators everywhere, Putin wants to make Russia great again. And he longs for that expansive influence of the days of the Soviet Union. So it's not just NATO, it's a democratic Western-backed Ukraine or Belarus or Georgia or insert former Soviet Republic here is not just a military threat. It's a threat to his effort to reclaim Russian greatness. And at a time when Russia's economy is terrible, it's also a threat to his power within Russia. And so I think that there's this sort of pumping out the chest and putting troops on the border is deeper than just the NATO thing. I think it's like he's seeing what's going on in Ukraine as a much deeper threat to his power regionally and at home.
Yeah, and what's interesting is, I think in 2014, that was sort of a one-sided stakes, right? Where Russia had everything at stake, you know, the stability of Putin's regime, his vision of making Russia great again, his hope of maintaining popular support. Now, I think it's a little bit bigger than that for the US specifically.
Yeah.
Francis Fukuyama, who's now at Stanford, wrote an article on this this week, basically indicating that, you know, if the US is not able to protect Ukraine in this situation, along with its allies, that is a big signal of the continued decline of US power and influence around the world and the end of this era of hegemony post-Cold War. And that, you know, most pressingly, it's a signal to China that any security guarantees for Taiwan may not be as real or at least as defensible as, right. as they might fear, but that it really is, would be an indicator of a shift in the ability of the US to guarantee security of its allies, project power and exert influence around the world.
Yeah. And you're not the first person to make the parallel between Taiwan and Ukraine here. I mean, I think that it's not an exact parallel, but I think the points that you were made are not only well taken by me, I think they're well understood. Mm-hmm. And I think this is why the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, said, you know, that the U.S., he said, things we did not do in 2014, we are prepared to do now.
Yep.
And I think that's a direct reflection of kind of the more sober understanding, not only of the challenge set, but of the signal that it could send one way or another.
Which, did you watch his press conference today?
I did not. I just read about it.
So he's very good. I have become a bit of a Jake Sullivan stan, and I will continue to watch his pressers in the future. He was great up there.
I've always been a Jake Sullivan stan, quite frankly. And that's partly because, man, this is an unanticipated tangent. It's partly because he has a really good reputation in Washington for being kind of not one of these people that made it to the top with sharp elbows, but actually by building up the people around him. I'm sure he's yelled at somebody over time, or I'm sure there's been some, you know, something that somebody can pull up from his past, and I don't want to diminish that. But I think he has this reputation of being good, or at least being civil and nice to the people around him that work for him. And I don't know, as someone who would like to consider himself a nice person who likes to build other people up, it's always been kind of a North Star for me.
Yeah, there was just, so that's not surprising in that there was something almost military about his style. And I think among military people, you also have that tendency toward, you know, authentic leadership and building up people around them. But stylistically, he was very direct and precise with his words, but in a way that wasn't trying to hide anything. It was just very kind of factual, well thought through, clear that he was prepared, and well done.
Yeah, I mean, he's also whip smart. Yeah, just the last thing on this Russia Ukraine, since you brought up kind of the U.S. responses and what are the tools that we have in our toolbox, I think whether Putin and Russia invades Ukraine will depend a lot on what we're talking about. It will depend a lot on his perception of how far he thinks the West will go in their willingness to protect Ukraine. And so far, it's been a lot of sort of vague words, but Putin's belief on the veracity of the option set behind those words, I think, will be directly related to whether or not he invades. Yeah, it's a bit like this red lines conversation in Syria, where, you know, Republicans have hit the Obama administration over and over again about, they drew a red line in the sand about the usage of chemical weapons, and then chemical weapons were used and they didn't do anything about it. And so I wonder how much of this statement by Jake Sullivan and Joe Biden himself pledging to make it, quote unquote, very, very difficult for Putin to attack Ukraine, I wonder how much of that is kind of a sober reflection of the shortcomings of previous policy choices for inaction.
Right.
So, you know,
so when Biden says, or when Sullivan says, we're prepared to do things we didn't do in 2014, what's he talking about?
Yeah. I mean, I think they're holding some of those cards deliberately close to the chest, but smart money is on some combination of economic tools, right? I mean, Russians are already, senior members of the Russian government are already under sanctions. So there's sort of limited individual sanctions that can be ratcheted up, but there are things like you can remove Russia from the global financial payment system, SWIFT. You can do some kind of like sector related sanctions. Mm-hmm. So there's sort of like the economic stuff, but then there's this, you know, there's this very, lots of people talk about the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Marco Rubio loves to talk about this pipeline and how it should be canceled and everything. It's basically going to take natural gas from Russia to Germany.
Yep.
And so in vintage Biden fashion, before he talked with Putin today, he coordinated with the Germans to say, if there is a, and I don't know if this is public or just sort of speculated, I can't remember in the articles that I was reading, but he coordinated with the Germans. We do know that. And the supposition is that if Russia invades Ukraine, then Germany will cancel this pipeline. And that would be bad for Russia.
Which is a huge ask for Angela Merkel's last day in office.
Oh, by the way, Angela, on your way out.
So I don't entirely understand the leverage that the West supposedly has over Nord Stream 2. Specifically, the concern in terms of geopolitics with Nord Stream 2 is that it would be a way for Russia to circumvent Ukraine and having a direct route to supply natural gas to Europe. Currently, because all of their gas goes through Ukraine, they're paying out billions of dollars a year to Ukraine in fees for moving that gas. And they are somewhat dependent on, you know, friendly relations with Ukraine. It creates economic ties. The problem that I see is if they invade Ukraine and they control that country, can't they just start moving gas through Ukraine for free and they don't really need the pipeline anymore?
Even if Russia were to invade Ukraine, I don't think that there is an envisioned world that all but the most extreme pessimist think is a possibility, that Russia actually like subsumes Ukraine such that it's just a state in or a province in Russia. I think the most likely outcome, if Russia were to militarily engage, is that they would install a Ukrainian who is pro-Russia, like a Viktor Yushchenko, I think was his name, or Yukashenko, I can't remember. And I think that's what most people think is going to happen. So in that way, yes, perhaps they could then control the Ukraine. But I mean, so much of Ukraine's national income is dependent on that.
Yeah.
So I think for the reasons that you said, though, there is leverage because Russia wants to circumnavigate Ukraine. And Germany and other EU partners would like to not have the instability of just relying on Ukrainian gas. And so there's mutual benefit, but I think there is some leverage in that Russia wants this perhaps slightly more than the EU does for all the reasons that you laid out.
My last question on this is, doesn't Vladimir Putin like study history to some extent? Like, who's trying to launch a ground invasion in that part of the world in December?
Yeah, it seemed weird to me too. Like, why are you amassing troops now? Like, why don't you wait for the spring or something? I don't know is the answer to that question. But the one thing that we haven't talked about though, and this is the last point, is like the elephant in the room is like, are non-Ukrainian troops going to be deployed to support Ukraine? And I think this is probably where the Ukrainians are at right now. They're like, all of these economic tools that you have and all these sanctions and Nord to this, it's like, that's all just geoeconomic gobbledygook when there's 175,000 heavily armed Russians amassing at our borders. What are you going to do about that? I think that's that. Those are the hard conversations that are happening in the Situation Room. Like, you can imagine Joe Biden is reviewing plans that have perhaps been co-developed with European allies. I'm not saying that U.S. troops are going to be deployed. I think there's very little appetite for that necessarily here in the United States, but it's certainly not out of the realm of possibility that NATO, even though Ukraine is not a member of NATO, that NATO does sort of like an Afghanistan-like ISAF kind of mission to protect, or maybe it's done through UN peacekeepers or something like that. But
NATO does have troops in Ukraine and across the Baltics right now.
Yes. They would just have to significantly ratchet up to be able to respond to a Russian invasion, and you know, direct confrontation with Russia is not something, right. It's something that people are thinking about, I think, behind closed doors, and there's all sorts of war gaming and war planning, but I think that's a pretty scary potential outcome.
For sure. When Jake Sullivan was asked about it in the press conference, he basically said, this isn't like a switch you turn on or off. There is a troop presence there now. We are supplying Ukrainian defense forces with materiel now. The question is, do we ratchet that up and by how much?
Which to me means all options are on the table.
Right.
Well, Mike, I think it's pretty hard to fix what's going on in Eastern Ukraine, but you know, I think I did a pretty good job.
I think we fixed it. I think we fixed something. I don't know exactly what, but
I think I fixed the freaking like Olympic boycott.
That's the beauty of the "we fixed it" you know, mission accomplished statement at the end of every every call is, we don't say what it is. It's fine.
That's true. Great to see you, my friend. We'll see you next week.
Excellent. News and Brews is hosted by Mike Heslin and Errol Yabuke. Our producer is Alana Nevins. This episode was recorded Tuesday, December 7th, 2021 at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Look out for new episodes available each Wednesday on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.